Some of the earliest mosques in the U.S. were built right here in the Midwest. Today on the 21st, we hear stories about how Muslim communities in this part of the country grew from almost nothing.
There were only 12 to 15 Muslim families in the greater Springfield area, and today there are over 300.
Plus, for more than 100 years, Sears was special to many people in Illinois. As the company has fallen on hard times, retirees tell us what the company meant to them.
Sears offered Americans the opportunity to realize the dream of the middle class in an affordable way. And beyond that, Sears was a good place to work.
But first, as the academic year is in full swing, we'll revisit our conversation about affirmative action in college admissions.
Those who care about affirmative action probably do well to pray for the health of current members of the Supreme Court.
That's all coming up on this encore edition of the 21st after this news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. It's the first full academic year under the Trump administration, and many colleges in Illinois are watching closely as the Justice and Education Departments in recent months signaled a potential shift in priorities when it comes to race and admissions on campuses across the country. The New York Times reported the Justice Department was looking for investigators to take up cases that were widely interpreted to include accusations of discrimination against students who are white. Separately, a private lawsuit was filed against Harvard by a group of Asian American students. That suit claims that Asian Americans face a higher bar for admission than other groups like Latino or African American students. Joining me now to help us understand all of this and look ahead a little bit is Ebony Zamani Gallagher. She's professor of higher education and community college leadership at the University of Illinois. And also on the line from Washington, Scott Jasek. He's the editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Now, Ebony, why don't we start with you? I mean, many states, and campuses have different policies when it comes to how race is or is not factored into admissions. Can you just kind of start in Illinois in general? What do we see from Illinois colleges and universities in that regard?
Well, I think that when we talk about the retrenchment on affirmative action and the extent to which it's been contentious, it's been largely in terms of the elite institutions. And so the public flagships, Ivy institutions, and likewise in Illinois, there haven't been necessarily affirmative action lawsuits or claims.
Mm-hmm. Like we've seen in Michigan or
like
Texas
we've seen
recently,
at the U of M or UT with the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. Let alone our comprehensive state colleges. But I do think that we're at a time where Illinois, like its peer institutions, will need to have some documentation, need to really think about how they're documenting, legitimizing, making arguments and justifying their affirmative action program, similar
so
to
does
how
UT
have
a different. It varies from campus to campus.
It can
from
vary
school,
from campus
from
to campus.
College.
It can, but I think the key term is what do we mean by affirmative action, and it varies depending on who you ask. And from the onset, it was to provide a non-discriminatory society, to eradicate the previous discrimination of blacks and other minorities. And then over time got conflated with tokenism and reverse discrimination and the like. But by and large, affirmative action is really efforts to get rid of, exclusionary practices.
I would like to talk a little bit, there's some data out there. I mean, the New York Times also recently put together an article showing, how effective or not some of these policies are. But for a minute, Scott Jasek, just turning to you, in a broader perspective, and what are you seeing across different campuses outside of Illinois around the country? How is race and ethnicity playing in terms of factor into college admissions, and how different is it across colleges as you're seeing?
Well, it's very different, and it's mainly a factor, as you just heard, in elite college admissions. It's important to remember that most colleges do not consider race and ethnicity in admissions. Most colleges aren't competitive in admissions. And in fact, most minority students don't attend colleges that use race and ethnicity in admissions. If you care the most about the institutions where minority students enroll, you should be focusing at community colleges, at public, more open admissions institutions that serve lots and lots of minority students. At the same time, what happens at elite higher education is very important. The key, I think, is that the Supreme Court has never said it's okay, just do it. They've said it's okay if you have a clear rationale and a plan. You've got to, colleges need to show, whether they're in Illinois or elsewhere, colleges need to show that they have considered non-race specific measures and that they wouldn't work. Colleges have to show that they are taking steps to minimize the impact on those who don't benefit. And colleges get a lot of points, going back to a Sandra Day O'Connor opinion, in showing that they hope it won't be needed forever, that they don't view this as a long-term thing. So colleges have successfully, most recently the University of Texas, have successfully defended plans, but it took a lot of research and a lot of work. Where colleges may be vulnerable is if they haven't been doing that work.
So kind of, like, I mean, you're talking about the documenting there and having a process that's very clear and laid out. Scott, I mean, just what does that look like? I mean, can you pull back the curtain a little bit? You've done a lot of reporting on this and dug into the issue too. You know, if I'm a college admissions officer, what does that look like day to day through the admissions policy? How does it play into how I'm doing my job?
So generally, most colleges that consider race and ethnicity use what is known as holistic admissions. And in fact, if they want to consider race and ethnicity, they almost have to. Holistic admissions is, you don't have a formula that says this GPA plus this ACT score yields admissions. It means you're looking at everything. And that may include race and ethnicity, but it includes grades, it includes test scores, it includes whether somebody has overcome adversity of certain kinds, it includes whether they play the tuba and you need a tuba player, it includes their academic interests, where they're from. I mean, in a place like, in a state like Illinois, at your public institutions, I'm sure there are wealthy suburbs that send tons of students, and then neighborhoods in parts of Chicago or in rural areas that don't. There are lots of things to consider. And what you have to show with holistic admissions is that it is holistic, that you don't have separate standards. Where colleges have gotten in the trouble in the past is if they just give points for certain things, so they're not looking at the individual.
I see. Okay. So, and with all of that in mind, then, if that's sort of how the process is looking kind of on the back end, I mean, Ebony's Imani Gallagher, then in terms of the goals, I mean, what is the hopeful goal or end result of all of that work?
So I think the end result is to foster equitable student outcomes across diverse student groups, and we're still not there yet. So, you know, to Scott's point, part of how we get there is thinking about the student and the student's entirety, right? And so this holistic approach to how we admit our class and understanding that diversity has a compelling state interest for our campuses. And because our society, with the changing demographics, has never been more culturally pluralistic as to our campuses as a reflection of that, we have to have measures to have that diversity show on campus. But, you know, I guess I want to kind of go back to the point about the holistic piece and the tensions around affirmative action and what the DOJ is proposing to do from our understanding.
So what are we, to bring it back to the now, I mean, what are we hearing right now? What are you thinking?
Well, my understanding is that the Department of Justice plans to investigate, that there could potentially be some suits involved, the extent to which they deem intentional discrimination for certain groups. And the certain groups, namely, are white and Asian students. And so I think when we talk about has affirmative action worked and where do we see kind of the success, again, with elite schools, to the point of the recent New York Times article, there's been little to no change. But at the same time, that's only looking at flagship institutions. Mm-hmm. That's not looking at all of these other institutional types.
I mean, just to let folks know, if they didn't see that article, there was a they did a series of graphs that listed multiple schools, some of the higher level elite universities, including the University of Illinois, Northwestern, Illinois, among others. And it showed that even with affirmative action on many of these campuses, there was little, if any, and in many cases even declines in enrollment among African-American and Latino students, and some increases in Asian students, if I'm getting that right.
Right. You know, I can make a parallel to that article with the University of Illinois. So in the article, it spoke to, for African-American students, for example, that they comprise 15% of the freshman class, but they're only 6% of student college goers. So if you look at 15% of college age Americans being black, but only 6%, again, at these elite institutions. Well, Illinois, too, the total percent of African American students is 6%. And so we see where there's still disproportionate representation when we disaggregate the data by race and ethnicity.
So, Scott, I mean, you had mentioned there, you know, you talked a little bit about what we're hearing from the federal government. Scott, can you kind of fill us in? What is the federal government's role in all of this? I mean, you know, we're hearing different things from the Trump administration than we did from the Obama administration. When it comes to affirmative action, what role does the executive branch play? And what are you seeing and hearing that might hint at what's to come?
Well, here it seems to be coming from the Justice Department, not the Education Department.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing they could do is back the suit against Harvard that you mentioned.
And that's a student with the Asian American students saying that they were blocked.
The Asian American. And they very much want, generally, critics of affirmative action like to portray Asians as the victim, not white people, because mm-hmm. they, frankly, look better if they're advocates for another minority group. It is also the case that, on average, Asians' test scores and grades have skyrocketed. ACT data came out in which Asians, on average, were exceeding white students and every other group. So, but I think it's disingenuous to say this is just about Asians, because if they question the use of race and ethnicity, mm-hmm. it will affect all groups. But what's interesting about Asians, if you look at California and Michigan, which California by referendum in the state banned the consideration of race, what happened initially, big drop in Black and Latino enrollments, and a surge in Asians, not whites. So people who think this will help white students are probably wrong. And that's because even in those states, they can still consider economic disadvantage, which affects all groups but includes Asian Americans. So I don't think you'll see that. In California, the Latino enrollment has gone up over time, but that's largely because the Latino population of the state has gone up so much. African American enrollment remains minimal, and also that is the case at the University of Michigan, which is nearby and also operating this way. I think if you want to talk long-term, as Sandra Day O'Connor encouraged, frankly, people need to be looking at elementary schools. People need to look at prenatal care. People need to look at the entire educational landscape. But the problem is, if you do that and you just eliminate all consideration of race now, you will see a big drop in the number of Black and Latino professionals in American society. You will also, and this is a key part to the legal defense of affirmative action, you will also affect the education of all students. Mm-hmm. A key basis for defending affirmative action is that all students, white students too, benefit from being in an educational environment where everyone isn't just like them. And so you would see a real change in the picture. At the same time, it's early going. We don't know quite what the Justice Department is doing, but if they were to challenge Harvard, every college in America would take note.
Just a couple of questions here as we wrap up. And Ebony, I'll turn to you. You were talking before about some of the legal actions on this. So we've seen cases, the Texas case, you know, which sort of upheld that as part of a holistic process that you could use race and ethnicity as part of an admissions process. In Michigan, there was a different take. The court upheld that a state could ban, in some cases, the use. So you can do it in certain cases, but you don't have to. So the court's sort of laying out some different parallels there. But a lot of this does seem to be ripe for lawsuits being decided in courts. You know, I've seen several over the years there. You know, why does so much seem to get brought up in the courts, and what impact could that have?
The good news is last year with UT Austin and their affirmative action plan being upheld, is affirmative action is still kind of the lay of the land, so to speak. And so diversity is a compelling state interest. In the case of Michigan, there were two different cases, right? The Gratz case as well as the Grutter case. And it was more of a split decision of sorts. So on one hand, there is affirmative action done wrong. You can't have quotas. You can't have set-asides. But there's also affirmative action that has that holistic admissions, mm-hmm. and you have very much demonstrated the criteria that you're using, where there's a litany of different things on the table for how that student body is brought in.
So it's impossible to sort of predict the future in some cases like this, but as cases seem to be coming to the court, as you see this case come up with the Asian American students suing now Harvard, I mean, do you have any sense or any expectation as somebody who watches what goes on with colleges and hears from colleges and universities about what could be next?
Right now, we have 8 states where we've had ballot initiatives. There have been referendums and affirmative action has been retrenched. I think under the Trump administration, that is actually probably going to occur. We'll have an uptick as we approach the next election cycle where we may see some ballot initiatives to have additional states ban affirmative action.
Like California effectively did.
And Michigan, yes.
Scott, I think we've only got a minute left here, but same question to you. I mean, sort of as you look at some of these cases and what's going on right now and some of these hints, as we said, out of D.C. right now, what's your expectation?
Right now, I would think it is the status quo, but those who care about affirmative action probably do well to pray for the health of current members of the Supreme Court. I think the change, the replacement of Scalia didn't change things much because Scalia was very anti-affirmative action. But if there were additional changes from the justices who have supported it, who knows what we might see.
Well, that's Scott Jasek, editor and co-founder of Inside Higher Ed. Also in the studio with us, Ebony Zamani Gallagher, professor of higher education, community college leadership at the University of Illinois. Thank you both. I appreciate the time today.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. You know, more than 80 years ago, a small group of Muslims in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, opened up a mosque called the Muslim Temple using money they had cobbled together during the Great Depression. It's considered one of the first mosques in North America. It's not the only Islamic community with deep roots in the Midwest. In places like Iowa and North Dakota, early community of Muslims in the 1920s and 30s gathered to try and build a new home for themselves. In fact, the oldest Islamic organization believed to be in the U.S. is in Chicago still. Joining me now to help us learn more about this history is Ryan Schisler. He's a freelance journalist who writes about religion, the environment, and social justice. Ryan, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you know, this history, you know, I guess I would have thought, made some assumptions that larger cities, East Coast cities maybe, might have played a big role in the history of Muslim Americans, but it turns out some of the deepest roots are here in the Midwest. How did this happen?
That's right. Well, the stories of these Muslim communities in the Midwest share the same roots as any immigrant community in this region. They came because land was plentiful and land was cheap, and they were starting new lives for themselves at the beginning of the 20th century.
And I mean, that is largely the story of the growth of America. The group I mentioned in Chicago, I mean, specifically, can you just tell us a little bit about that and the history there and who founded that?
Right. That organization you mentioned was founded in 1906, and it was a benevolent society for Bosnian immigrants from Southeast Europe. They were mostly at first young men who had been contracted to come and help rebuild Chicago after the Great Chicago Fire, but later started families and remained. And that organization acted in its later years as an organization that did funerary arrangements for its members. But it's still around today, and that community has had several mosques in and around Chicago throughout the last century.
And I understand also, so that, I mean, that goes back to the Chicago Fire. That's the late 1800s at that point. You've got primarily men, you said, coming over from Bosnia and from that region. And I understand it also grew, at least in some instances, out of Chicago into other parts of the country.
Right. That organization had chapters in other cities like Gary, Indiana, Pittsburgh, and as far west as Boise, Idaho, and even Los Angeles. But it's also important to note that in Chicago specifically, this organization had some contemporaries, in that in the early 1900s, the early days of conversions of African-American families to Islam was beginning, and there's mosques in Chicago that have roots in about that same time as well, especially on the north side.
You know, we briefly mentioned earlier what was called the Moslem Temple. That was in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, now called the Mother Mosque, recognized as the first mosque in North America, you know, built for that purpose. What was that like? How did that come to be? What was it like for the first Muslims in that area to try and build a religious community essentially from scratch?
Well, they came at the end of the 1800s, mostly as peddlers who were going across the prairie, not just in Iowa, but in the Dakotas as well. But they, like any religious group, needed a house of worship eventually. And as their numbers grew in Cedar Rapids, they were able to financially build that mosque. And then it also has a contemporary in the town of Ross, North Dakota, along the northwest border of North Dakota and Montana. There was a community of Syrian homesteaders there that built a mosque around the same time, but it wasn't the first purpose-built mosque. There's some records that indicate it was actually a repurposed barn, which is why the Mother Mosque in Cedar Rapids is known as the first purpose-built mosque. And it's still there. The one in North Dakota, sadly, was torn down in the 70s.
Well, and the mosque in Cedar Rapids, too, has had some rough moments. Remember the floods several years ago? I think it was 2008. You had written about, you know, but an instance where it is such a fixture in the community that the community really rallied around it when that happened. Can you kind of take us back to that moment in 2008 and what happened and sort of the response from the community?
That's right. I only heard about the flood in 2008 after the fact. I wasn't there covering it when it was going on. But the imam there at the Mother Mosque told me about how once that neighborhood was flooded and the waters had receded, the mosque was severely damaged, though not completely totaled like many of the houses in that neighborhood. But they put out a call for help, and as the imam told me, buses of people of all different religious backgrounds came just because the Mother Mosque is such a fixture in that community and a point of pride for many in Cedar Rapids.
You know, I want to bring someone else into this conversation from Springfield here in Illinois, Maryam Mostofi, chaplain spokesperson with the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
You were a part of the first group of Muslim families in the Springfield area. This goes back to around the late 70s, I understand. Can you kind of take us back to that moment? I mean, what was that like? We've heard sort of a national perspective here and kind of the role of the Midwest in general. But right here in Illinois, there are stories to tell, too. What was that like to come and to worship in the early days of your community when there was not an established structure?
Well, when we first arrived, it was 1979 when my family and I moved to Springfield. And at that time, we didn't know any other Muslims. It was a couple years before we actually met other Muslims in the community because there wasn't a central house of worship to where we could go and find other people of our faith. So it was by coincidence that I was introduced to someone who was Muslim, and then from there began to meet other people. And at that time, in 1979, there were, by that time I guess it would be about 1982, there were only 12 to 15 Muslim families in the greater Springfield area, and today there are over 300. And it was in 1985 that we incorporated and became officially the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. And we purchased our first mosque the year after. And it was a repurposed building that we converted to our own needs. Sadly, in June of 1994, arsonists set it afire and burned it to the ground.
Yeah, and that's definitely something that we would want to hear a little bit more about. I don't know if many people outside of the Springfield area may know that story. You know, just thinking about what you described in the rapid growth of the community there, I mean, how important was it to have that community start to become established for the community to grow in that way? I know you said it wasn't until the mid-80s that there was a formal structure there, but you mentioned going from really not knowing anybody to, you know, having about 15 families and then sort of very quickly growing from there. Once those connections started to be made, was that social and community structure important to the growth there, or was it just sort of coincidence?
It really was, but it was also the growth of the community once we had our own masjid or mosque was a place where people could gather. And it was something that you could identify an Islamic community by. So that when people were interviewing for jobs in the Springfield area, for instance, with the medical school or wherever, one of the first questions they would ask is there a mosque here in Springfield? And because we had great relationships with people in various employment positions, whether it was the medical school or state government or wherever, we could probably say, you know, these people were aware, yes, there is a mosque. So people began to connect, and that was one of the reasons that they were attracted to the Springfield area, was because there was a small and growing mosque. And so that began to build our community.
And what was the relationship there with the greater Springfield area, I guess, in those early days? And then what is it like now? How do those compare?
Well, we had a very good relationship, I think, with the greater Springfield community. I think the individuals that were responsible for the arson, although they've never been caught, I think that was not the norm. I think they were the exception rather than the rule, because we found that within a few hours of it having been made public that our mosque had been burned, five different houses of worship, one synagogue, and four churches offered their places of worship for us.
Wow. So again, that kind of community building. I mean, take us back. Now, you've mentioned the Arsenault a couple of times. You know, this was 1994, I think you said. This was a difficult time. Can you kind of describe what happened?
Well, it was early in the morning when I was notified that the mosque had been burned. And, of course, we went to the site immediately, and we began to I personally contacted a man by the name of Larry Golden, who at that time was the chair of our the Coalition to Promote Human Dignity and Diversity, which was a group I was a member of that worked to challenge hate crimes, to build and capitalize on the diversity of our community, and educate other people about the value of diversity. So once I notified him as to what had happened, then he sent out a fax blast to the whole community and all of our membership organizations. And they responded, demanding from law enforcement and the media that this story be covered. You have to understand, this wasn't the only house of worship being burned in the United States that year. That was the same year that we saw a rise in the number of African-American churches that were being burned.
But, I mean, the mosque was clearly targeted, though.
Yes, it was very much targeted, yes. There was no doubt about that.
And how? What was the response then from the community? I mean, you described a little bit there and sort of reaching out and immediately saying we need to make sure that there is media coverage, that the people know what's going on here in the community. What happened next?
Well, people began to try to find ways that they could help our community overcome the problems that we were experiencing at the time. In fact, we had the Jewish Federation here in Springfield contacted one of their members, and who was an attorney, and he represented us pro bono so that we could get our insurance claim. We had, like I said, houses of worship that offered their places to us. We had just a tremendous outpouring. Congregations donated money to help rebuild. I, for one, had an opportunity to sit down with then Attorney General Jim Ryan and talk with him about what had happened, and he promised that he would work towards improved reporting and tracking guidelines related to hate crimes. Mm-hmm. And within 6 months, we had much tougher legislation in Illinois that had been passed by both houses.
Wow. So some
that made a big impact, not only on hate crimes that targeted Muslims, but that targeted other minority groups as well.
I mean, it sounds like it's an emotional roller coaster. I mean, to have that an act of hate like that targeting you, your mosque, your community, and then also having this outpouring of support and response and changes in policy and law and in structure, that just sounds like a remarkable moment.
It was. It was an opportunity, though, that we couldn't overlook that. We couldn't just sit and dwell in our own grief at the loss of our mosque. It was an opportunity to do something for the larger community, which, of course, we're a part of.
Yeah.
And that was important because the Muslims within the Springfield community have been very active on social justice issues from the very beginning, and others responded in kind to us. And so it was an opportunity for us to become even more involved in other issues, and we felt an obligation to do that.
And that is the voice of Maryam Mostofi, chaplain and spokesperson of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield. Also on the line is Ryan Schisler, freelance journalist, writes about religion, environment, and social justice. We're talking about the role of the Midwest in the growth of American Muslim communities, but from North Dakota through Iowa and here right into to Illinois, from Springfield to Chicago. You know, I want to come back for a minute, Ryan, to you. You know, you went and visited some of the mosques you've talked about here fairly recently. What's changed? What are those communities like now?
Well, the biggest change that I've noticed of the ones I've visited is that in Ross, North Dakota, where the number of practicing Muslims is actually probably less than 10, if that. Most people throughout the generations married to Christian families, converted, or moved away. And what's really touching about that story is even though the original mosque is no longer there, there's actually a cemetery there that's still maintained by these families, which includes veterans from World War I and World War II. And these descendants who are no longer Muslims still come back to this place in North Dakota from the other states where they live and clean and maintain this site that's really in the middle of the prairie. It's about an hour drive from the nearest city. These mosques and organizations that I've talked about, they were the first incorporated, but they weren't necessarily the first individuals or families that came to the Midwest. Among the hundreds of estimated Muslims that served in the Union Army during the American Civil War, one named Moses Osman was the highest ranking of them, and he's buried here in Illinois. And he served in the 114th Illinois Infantry, I believe. And then a latter point that I wanted to make is the story of these immigrant groups coming to the Midwest at the turn of the 20th century. It's a story that's still being told today because the same things that attracted those groups then are attracting them now, and that's really affordability of this region. And the story of Muslim immigration to the U.S. continues to have a really prominent role in the Midwest, with examples in St. Louis, which now has the largest population of Bosnians in the country, Minneapolis, that has the largest population of Somalis, and, of course, the Arabs in Detroit and Dearborn. It's an ongoing story, not just a historical one, and it's one that really is a centerpiece of our region for the past century, not longer.
Maryam, coming back to you, and unfortunately we've only got a minute here left, but you know, you have this deep context here from your experience. We've talked a lot today about, you know, the larger history and things, but we're talking at a moment when there's a travel ban on people from some predominantly Muslim countries, when we've seen a jump in hate crimes and harassment around the country. Does this moment feel different to you?
It does. It feels very, very scary. But then I look at the generosity, the kindness of other people outside of the politicians, and it gives me hope. We've had occasions when people early in the morning, before even morning prayers, have come and put post-it notes all over the glass doors and windows at the front of the mosque, and left those notes of hope for us. And that's a beautiful thing. So we can dwell on what some of the politicians may be saying. We can dwell on the travel ban, but that's not going to help. We also have to acknowledge, recognize, and build on the relationships that we've developed and work towards something better in our future.
Yeah, and that's across groups, and that's across, and we, the group again in Chicago, we talked about Bosnian Muslim community. There are many different Muslim communities and other faith groups around the region and certainly around the state who are doing exactly what you just described there. And that was the voice of Maryam Mostofi, chaplain and spokesperson of the Islamic Society of Greater Springfield, also speaking with Ryan Schisler, freelance journalist, writes about religion, the environment, and social justice. Thank you both. I appreciate the time today.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
And you're listening to The 21st.
There's more for your life. Here's Cooler Gum, Muzzler 2, VCRs and Big Screen View.
There's more for your life.
That's it.
In store for you.
Wilson styles for having fun. Free spirit bikes for everyone.
There's more for your life.
In store for your life.
There's more for your life.
More for your life.
That's it.
The retail giant Sears was born more than a century ago, and the company quickly became the place where America shops, as the slogan went. One analyst even credited the Illinois-based retailer with democratizing retail in the country. A lot has changed since then. Earlier this year, the parent company warned that, quote, substantial doubt exists about the company's ability to survive. Hundreds of stores are closing or closed, and just last week, Sears announced 43 more stores will close across the country, including one in Peru, Illinois. It's about 60 miles north of Peoria. Many Illinois residents had long careers at Sears and saw this all play out up close. Those include Ron Olbrich, chairman of the National Association of Retired Sears Employees, based in Chicago. Also, Dick Bruce and Bill Barker, members of that association. They join us now here by phone. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for talking to us.
It's good to be with you today.
Well, hi. Thank you for the opportunity to be on the show.
No, of course. I mean, let's start with you. I mean, take us back to, you know, 1972. You first began working at Sears sort of right after the heyday of the store in some ways and leading into some of its better years. You know, what was it like to work for Sears back then?
Well, first of all, it was a great company to work for. When I joined the company, it was the number one retailer in the country, if not the world. The salary was good. I was able to put four kids through college, great benefits. We had discounts on merchandise. We had profit sharing, paid up life insurance, medical insurance, et cetera. And when I started with Sears, I started as a trademark attorney. And through the years, I handled advertising review, investigations, customer complaints, et cetera. And my last 12 years with the company was as assistant general counsel in the marketing practices section of the law department.
So, and I understand that you were sort of faced a choice. You know, you're looking at a couple of different jobs. That General Electric, I think, was one you were looking at. But how did you ultimately decide? What brought you to Sears?
Well, what brought me to Sears, as I said before, were the great benefits, and the company had a phenomenal reputation. And of course, that was back in 1972. Things started changing as we went on. In fact, when I joined Sears, it was known as the big store. Unfortunately, today, it's really now the shrinking store.
Mm-hmm. You know, and Dick, coming to you here for a minute, you know, what made you leave a management job? Now, I understand you were a training job at Ford to come to Sears. This is back in 1960. What brought you to Sears?
Well, actually, the time at Ford, and I had a love affair with automobiles, so I went to work for them, had great salary benefits and a good career ahead of me, but it was rather narrow, and I really thought that I could get myself into a better position career-wise with a company like Sears, as Ron pointed out. When I went to work for them in 60, it was the country's largest employer, was the fourth or fifth biggest revenue producer, and was a significant percentage of the country's gross national product, and books such as Merchant to the Millions and The Big Store were written about Sears. And the benefits, of course, were unparalleled in terms of what people were able to look forward to. And then the fact that Sears expanded internationally and our expertise was being sought by other countries, major retailers such as Walton's in Australia and Cebu Seyu in Japan and such as that. And of course, you know, I could go on and on about what has happened since that time. But
yeah,
at the point of going to work for Sears, I like the idea of the varied opportunities that were available career-wise, a lot of diversity.
Well, and I'm hearing, too, you know, that you're talking about the benefits and the pay and things. I'm also hearing, as you describe Sears of what it meant to work there, that there was a prestige there, that, you know, now, while there may be certain prestige to work in, you know, a high-tech sector or certain industries like that, that at that moment, Sears was kind of the place to be. Bill, was that your experience?
Well, mine is quite different. I came to Sears after I had immigrated from Scotland, and I was in the British Merchant Navy and had gone through the maritime school and was a, what you say, officer cadet, and finished my seagoing career as a fourth officer on a British shipping company. Met my wife in New York in 56, and they left the sea in 58. And I came ashore considered an alien, which I take exception to since I was from the UK, but no, that's another story, and just had to find a job. At that time, I was still young enough to be 1A, and everywhere I went, come back when you finished your military service. Well, I already been there during the Korean War, but because I was from the UK, that didn't count. So I got a job with Sears just to find a job near where I lived.
Nice, and that sort of became... Oh, go ahead.
And I'd heard of Sears as a good stock back in the UK, but at that time I wasn't too much interested in the financial aspects. So I came to Sears as a plumbing heating salesman, actually indoors, so it was a salary plus 1%, barely livable salary. And the store manager there kind of clicked on, and he mentored me, and I got to realize that I could retire at 55, although that seemed a long way off, with profit sharing, and saw some opportunities. Plus, I was mentored, eventually became his assistant in a small store in Jamaica, New York.
Ah, so it became a place that really sort of introduced you and helped you get settled
in
the country.
Yes, I had a mentor, so to speak. He realized where I'd been, and that was it.
Well, Ron, coming back to you, I mean, when you all get together now as part of the association, I mean, what do you talk about? Do you reminisce sort of the good old days? Do you talk about what's going on now? How do those conversations go?
Well, sure, we certainly reminisce. We have monthly meetings, and with our monthly meetings, we also have a toll-free conference call where we have retirees across the country join us to talk about what's happening with the company, the latest news about the company, and unfortunately, most of it has been negative, as you know.
Lately, yeah.
And you mentioned at the very beginning what Sears said several months ago when they said that, you know, substantial doubt exists relating to the company's ability to continue as a going concern. And looking back on my days with the company, I think that the company has made some major missteps. First thing, they failed to recognize Walmart. And that was a major, major error on their part.
Just recognize the level of competition that was coming from that model.
Oh, definitely. In fact, as an example, Walmart, I believe, was formed back in 1962, and it wasn't even on the Sears radar screen as a competitor. In 1980, Walmart had just passed $1 billion in revenues, and then in 1990, it passed Sears with $32 billion in revenues, and that was from a company that Sears at first failed to take seriously. And then, even more importantly, in the 90s, Amazon came on the scene, and Sears just completely ignored the digital revolution. They're trying to catch up now, but that was a problem.
You know, and all of you mentioned, you know, the salary in the... sorry, is that Dick?
I'm sorry. Yes, this is Dick.
Go ahead.
I wanted to do a little addendum there on the Amazon thing. You know, Sears made the mistake about not considering Walmart competition. They also, I think, made a grievous error in exiting the catalog with all of the countrywide distribution facilities that Sears had. And they had the opportunity, I think, well in advance of Amazon to be the equivalent of, or even more so than what the Amazon has become.
They had the infrastructure, you're saying, there to own that space without having to build out like Amazon did?
Yeah, and the facilities were all there. The expertise was there. You know, when you look at a company that has started Discover Card, Prodigy, Allstate, had picked up Dean Witter, which became Morgan Stanley, and Coldwell Banker. I mean, Sears was always on the rather leading edge and in advance of everything. And that doesn't mean that just because they fell on hard times, they no longer had the resources and talent to go ahead and have quite a large presence in that what you call the tech market, for instance.
Yeah.
And but you know, mistakes were made.
Well, you know, and Dick, I mean, as I hear you talk, and all of you, really, I mean, you know, Bill and Ron, it's you can hear in your voices. This is not just a company that's having trouble here. I mean, there is I get the sense that you're describing a loss of something bigger than, you know, any one particular company. Is that your sense?
Yes. I would certainly agree. This is Bill.
Yeah, Bill, go ahead.
I was a store runner, if you understand the term.
No, so what is that? Can you describe that to people who don't know?
A store runner was, I started as a salesman, went up through the ranks in the store, eventually became assistant store manager. In a couple of cases, I was a store manager, but leaning back from another job in the operating areas of a store. But in the early 1960s, me and my peers, who at that time were mostly assistant store managers or operating superintendents of large stores, we saw the discounters coming in. And we talked quite a bit about we were trying to go upscale, and the discounters were stealing our popcorn and eroding our market. It was brought up before. We saw ourselves as merchants to the millions, not to the elitist. But it seemed our then senior management was trying to go upscale and not paying much attention to the change in the marketplace. And this intensified more in the 70s and later, when some of us thought we should be having there was a prototype, I believe, S-Mart, smart stores. And that was dropped because that was not Sears, according to the powers to be. That would be the officer corps and the board. So I saw that forming as a store runner. And eventually, of course, I became operating manager for regions and the whole northern part of the country. But even during that, it was hard to get away from the mentality of that's not Sears. We did this and we did that, and discounting. The customers don't expect that from us. Central cashiers. Eventually, we had to go to central cashiers. But even there, we missed the boat.
Yeah, so lots of missed opportunities here that all three of you are describing over the years.
So
but you know,
the store for real
family. Interject for a minute?
Real quick, Ron. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, because you talked about nostalgia and reminiscing and everything. And when I reflect back on my career with Sears, it was like having the opportunity to work for many different countries because of the many different career changes that I was able to enjoy. I got to travel the company. A country and also many different countries because I spent time in the international operation. And one of the things that we always talk about or some of the things that I particularly missed is interacting with many of the key people in the organization as well as those in other companies. And Sears was very generous in terms of education, you know, whether it's sending me to the Harry Levinston Institute, teaching me Spanish for the international operations. It was basically a very, very not only good, but provided many experiences that I doubt I would have enjoyed with any other company.
Yeah, otherwise. And that's Dick Bruce, Sears retiree. I'm sorry, I think I called you Ron before.
Mm-hmm.
But Ron, coming back to you just for a minute, we've only got a couple of minutes here left, unfortunately, but What are your shopping habits like this? Do you still go to Sears? Are you a Sears shopper after all these years?
Well, probably like most other people now, I do my shopping primarily online. And as I said, it has had a great impact upon all the brick-and-mortar stores, not only Sears. As you know, Macy's is closing stores, JCPenney, Nordstrom, Kohl's, etc. And I think more and more people are shopping online rather than going to an actual store. And that's the result of the changing in the shopping habits of customers, primarily due to online buying. And as a result of that, all these brick-and-mortar stores have suffered lost revenues, and they've closed, you know, many of their stores. So to answer your question, no, I don't shop at Sears that much anymore.
Yeah, which is fairly representative, I suppose, of many others. We've only got 30 seconds left here, but one more question, and I suppose, Dick, let me ask you this just as a last point. You know, where are you now in terms of Sears and looking ahead? And, you know, are they going to make it? What are your feelings right now?
Okay, my opinion is that, yes, they are going to make it. They're going to be a much smaller company. The three of us that are on the phone had the opportunity to meet with some of the key management currently in place at Sears. We're very impressed with them and the direction they're taking the company. So I'm encouraged, even though it's not going to be the glory days that we all experienced. It looks like it's going to be. They're making some good moves.
All right. Well, that's Dick Bruce. We also talked with Bill Barker, Ron Ulbrich, all retirees from Sears. Ron, also the chairman of the National Association of Retired Sears Employees based in Chicago. Thank you very much. I appreciate the sort of the inside look at what's been going on and a look back at sort of what Sears meant to Illinois and the country. Thank you all for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the time that we have here for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can find all those links and directions for Alexa, too. Every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media, that's all at our website, 21stshow.org. I'm Scott Cameron. I've been sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.